You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny spring day. Oh, Don, today it's going to be 80 degrees. Can you believe that?
It is utterly spectacular here in the Sacramento Valley, here in Davis, California. We got to back up here. Lois and I are preparing this show on April 10, 2024 for broadcast on April 11, 2024. And guess what? It's sunny and it's warm and it's going to be, I don't know, what they say, 80 degrees or something like that today.
Yeah.
And just don't get too used to it, folks, because there's going to be a quick change in the weather coming up in a few days. Oh, it's lovely out there. It's mostly sunny today. Temperature right now is 63 degrees as we prepare the broadcast, going up to a high today of 79 degrees with a low tonight of 53 degrees. Isn't that a magic number to see there? And Thursday will be 82 and Thursday night will be 50 degrees and Friday will be 68 and Friday night will be 48 with a chance of showers. And Saturday, the high on Saturday, this is bumped up and down a little bit. Right now, as I speak, they're saying the high in Davis on Saturday will be 58 degrees.
Wait a minute.
With
the low, high then is 50. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, that's what tomato lovers and pepper lovers are saying. 58 degrees is going to be the high on Saturday, and the low Saturday night, because it's still going to be kind of cloudy, mostly cloudy, will be 46. Sunday will still also be kind of chilly with a 61 degree high. Sunday night, 46 degrees. Monday, warming up again to 69. Monday night, 47. Tuesday, 72. So this is kind of a cold storm pulling in rapidly. There's not a lot of rain associated with this one. Weather Underground, which likes to really quantify these things exactly, a couple of days ago was telling us we'd have half an inch on Saturday. Now it's being kind of split between Friday night and Saturday. Third of an inch to half an inch. The big difference is that high temperature, going from a high of 82 or 84, depending on which weather service you look at, down to a high of 56 to 58 on Saturday. This is not great for those who have already rushed and put out some of their summer vegetables into the garden. We are getting to the point where soil temperature is closer to where we like it to be, especially for those of you who have the advantage of raised planter beds. This is one advantage of raised planters. The soil does warm up. I'm less concerned now about tomatoes that have been put in the ground, but we did have a frost on our farm. I'm not kidding. 4 days ago. So very light, very pretty, sparkly frost, and the low that morning was 36 degrees. Here's one of the funny things about social media. I'm not a huge fan. I don't think it's the most useful way to communicate, but one thing that is interesting about Facebook is that every day for the last few days, up has popped one of those, here's what you were posting 11 years ago. Here's what you were posting 7 years ago. You know what they were? They were all frost notices. They were all cold temperature notices. I do this every year. When we get cold, I do post so that people can see why I keep saying, keep those plants on your porch, keep them in, you know, don't put them in the ground yet. We don't get frost in April every year. It's not a common thing here, and it's not a killing frost when it happens. I'm concerned about those low temperatures. And at least four times in the last decade, I have posted in the first week of April about unusually or temperatures of concern, let's put it that way, where it's dropping back down below where we like it. Tomatoes are tough plants, relatively speaking. So if you put them in the ground, we get cold, they'll turn kind of purplish and they won't be growing a whole lot, but they will recover. I'm not happy that a lot of nurseries have been selling peppers and eggplant and squash and melons and cucumbers like that for the last couple weeks, because this is not good for them. But in particular, peppers and things will be coming in. Our garden center will have some. We put them in the greenhouse with a sign that says peppers and eggplants are in the greenhouse. Please ask for assistance. We figure people will see that and go, huh, wonder why they have them in the greenhouse. And sometimes they make that connection. I'm less concerned about them than I am about members of Cucurbitaceae.
That's cucumbers.
And squash and melons. To me, the absolute threshold low temperature for those is 50 degrees. 55 is really what I should say, and 60 degrees as a minimum temperature would be even better. Because these are fast growing, kind of succulent, lush plants that don't have a lot of protective waxy layer on the leaves. Their stems are soft and as I say, rather succulent. And the roots, which grow very rapidly under ideal conditions, are very quickly and adversely affected by unideal conditions. They're tender in the literal sense of the word, yes. And if you put them in too early, they'll be set back to the point you probably should just put a new one in a couple of weeks. And I hate to say that because people have gone out and spent money on these things, but they will really be set back by cold night temperatures to the point where they'll spend a week or more recovering. And then if it happens again, they'll spend another week or more recovering. Really the best time to plant cucumbers, summer squash, melons is when it would be warm enough for you to just direct seed them out in the garden. Soil temperature is 65 degrees plus. In other words, mid-May towards the end of May in our area. Wherever you're listening, you'll have to adjust to your own temperature conditions. The only real reason for transplanting them rather than direct seeding them is that many people have problems with seedlings that come up disappearing very rapidly because many things like to eat seedlings. I have had just as good results transplanting out recently sprouted squash, melons, cucumbers as I have had direct seeding them. But I have to say, whenever you direct seed them, you must protect them somehow. Simplest way from the things that like to feed on seedlings, because they're very tender and apparently quite delicious to a lot of critters out there. So taking a strawberry basket and covering them over, if you have one in the ground, a really simple thing you can do if you're concerned about the temperatures we're going to be experiencing is that someone told me this, they do this, they go out and they get a plastic beverage cup and they poke a bunch of holes in the bottom and they invert it over the little seedling, okay? It's a little mini greenhouse. Now on an 84 degree day, that might cook it, but on a 62 degree day, you're probably fine. You should probably take that off every so often. That would be one thing you could possibly do, but really the simplest thing to do is wait. And here's another thing about all the members of that family. If they are root bound at the garden center, hardware store, the discount chain, wherever, don't buy them. If they're flowering, don't buy them. They should be throwing them out. Even at our store, where I'm very vigilant about this, they get past us sometimes. Big sprawling plants that are beginning to bloom, those don't transplant well. Look for the new, healthy, recently sprouted ones and wait for fresh crop if you have to. Or, you know, try some yourself from seed. I know a lot of people are very, very leery of doing things from seed. But that's the one group now that I'm most concerned about, is putting those in the ground when the nights get cold again and the soil is still colder than it should be. They're just not going to do well. So anyway, the weather's going to be weird, as usual, but we'll be warming up again next week, they promise us.
The good news about waiting until May to plant those things, all the little white crown sparrows, golden crown sparrows, juncos, they've all left by then.
You're right.
I mean, they're long gone. That's one less thing that's going to try and eat your little seedlings.
It actually was squash seedlings that I first encountered a problem with birds in my own garden. It wasn't white-crowned sparrows. I was planting them out and I'd come home and I did them direct seeded and I'd come home and I'd find them either gone or withering on the ground as if someone had carefully pulled them up. And I could not figure out for the life of me what it was till I happened to come home during the day and look out the window and a crow was hopping down the row, pulling each one up and dropping it. I mean, not even eating it, just dropping it right back where it was.
It was looking for the seeds. It was looking for the, you know, there should be an acorn under there or something. That's growing. Right.
Or maybe a worm or something. I don't know.
Oh, there's no acorn. I'll try the next one.
Do crows eat acorns? I don't know. But,
oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes. Crows, jays, magpies, they all like.
This was 45 or so years ago, and a wise gardener said, oh, just cover them with something. That was when I started my practice of covering the seeds directly in the ground with strawberry baskets. So hopefully you have a good supply of strawberry baskets handy. Anyway, you can wait. They'll be fine. And these are plants that grow very rapidly once they get going. So there's no advantage to early planting. There's a big disadvantage to it. You don't gain anything. So just be patient. You know, we're getting close. All the nurseries are full of summer vegetables now. All your little neighborhood friends are having plant sales, plant swaps. The local Davis parent nursery school is having a plant sale this weekend. The master gardeners are having one 2 weeks from now. They're all selling tomato seedlings and stuff, some fascinating stuff at those places. So it's a great time to start, you know, continue accumulating the varieties you want to put in the ground. The fact that your neighbor planted 3 weeks ago doesn't matter. Okay, don't worry about it. You're fine. Everything's going okay. All right, let's move on. KDRT is community radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And while you're there, you will find all kinds of great programming. And let's go ahead and talk about your upcoming show.
Well, actually, it's our upcoming show. You know, Don and I do this Davis Garden show all the time, and he does his own jazz show separately. I have a program of my own called That's Life, and I interview people. And guess what? I got to interview Don again. Yay! So we talked about jazz and its cousins. In other words, genres of musics that either derive from jazz or derive from the parents of jazz. Mm-hmm. And so it was a fascinating discussion.
KDRT also likes to do public service announcements. And one of our good friends here is the California Raptor Center at UC Davis, which is currently open to public visitation and accepting new patients. Please call when you arrive. Accepting new patients. Now, there's a, you know, avian flu outbreak, so they have to screen all the patients. When we refer to patients at the Raptor Center, we're not talking about you. We're talking about the raptor that you found somewhere. And they do help rehabilitate sick and injured birds, and they make an effort to restore them to the wild if they possibly can. Some become education ambassadors simply because they can't be restored to the wild. There are 30 resident birds presently at the California Raptor Center. If you're interested in raptors, there is a ton of information at their website. You can go for public visits, and it is CRC, which stands for California Raptor Center, crc.vetmed.ucdavis.edu.
Well, Don, it's April. It's the second Thursday in April. What's blooming in your yard?
The things that look most spectacular in my garden right now are the tea roses, the China roses, as we sometimes call them. And I think I sent over a picture, which I may post as our picture at on the Davis Garden Show page at KDRT.
Huge bush with completely covered with flowers.
Yeah, I tend to leave as many of my old-fashioned roses as possible, very lightly pruned, if at all. I let them get as big as they wish to get. I'm growing them as landscape shrubs, and I'm not growing them like, you know, hybrid tea or a conventional rose garden rose. And so I want them to be landscape shrubs. Remember, a rose is just a deciduous flowering shrub that blooms on new growth. 99% of the time, there are a few exceptions. And tea roses are the earliest roses to bloom. When I say tea rose, I'm referring to a whole group of roses that came in from China in the 19th century. Roses were first imported into Europe from China in the 1700s. And they were a huge sensation right away because they kept blooming. All roses prior to that time had only bloomed in the spring. Or if they put out a few blooms in the fall, people got unnaturally excited about it and called them autumn damask or something like that, because they actually would repeat bloom. Well, roses from China, which came from a more moderate temperature part of China, continue blooming. And in California and Texas and Louisiana and places where it's mild winter, they can actually bloom through the winter. These are the ones that just don't even stop blooming, like Old Blush, which we've been planting in this country for more than 200 years. I can go out in December, January and find a, maybe weather beaten, but find a bloom on it. But what they really do that's really spectacular in the landscape is they bloom as early as March, where the rest of your roses typically come into bloom in April. So I have a picture that I sent over to Lois of a rose called Mama Cochet, French name, on a China rose or tea rose from the late 19th century in full bloom. Probably has 50 or more blooms on it right now. Big sprawling plant that I clip very, very lightly. These are great garden plants. They're not a rose like grandma grows to have a long stem and bring into the house, but they are the ancestors of those modern hybrid tea roses.
And if I would describe this, I would say that each flower has a row of petals around the outside, but then inside that outer ring, there's a whole bunch of petals all folded up, fluffy, and folded up. And that's called quartering, isn't it, Don?
Yeah, and these are heavily doubled. These particular ones are. But what the tea roses had that was different than the hybrid perpetual roses of the 19th century is they have less of that than those older fashioned roses did. And they, in many cases, if you would get in and look closely at the flower buds on these, they have sometimes, frequently, the perfect overlapping petals, the high point, the very elegant look of a modern rose. So these were the parents of hybrid tea roses, which are the main group of roses everybody grows or has grown at least through the 20th century, because they look so perfect. But they're both. You can see on this plant, they open out rapidly. There's a lot of doubleness to them. I think that's fine. I think that's very cool. But that they were the beginning of that look and the process where breeders started to strive for that perfect look of a rose flower with the overlapping petals and the high center. So they have both. They also have what I describe as a tea rose scent. And this gets us to an interesting topic that comes up periodically at my garden center.
What does a rose smell like?
Yeah, what is the most fragrant rose? Why don't modern roses smell as good as old-fashioned roses, et cetera, et cetera? Well, part of it is the tea rose parentage. Tea rose, the name is kind of funny. Some people think it means they smell like tea. Well, that's a rather...
They came in on the ships that brought the tea from China.
They came in boxes from the Fa Li Tea Company, which is the one shipping the roses originally from China to Europe and England and then the United States as well. And so they just got casually called tea roses. They do have a light scent that's kind of reminiscent of tea, I guess. I mean, tea is a pretty broad category. But I'm going to say something that I've observed over the years, and people walk up to this rose blooming on my property and they all say, some say, oh, I like that smell. It's light. It's kind of like soap, but a really pretty smell. And others walk up and others say, I don't smell anything. I have concluded that a certain percentage of the population cannot smell tea roses, simply cannot smell them.
You think it's like that cilantro thing? Because I know cilantro tastes like soap to me, whereas to other people, doesn't.
Well, there's a certain, it's like 30% of the population, you and I both included, who don't like the taste of cilantro because it tastes very soapy. I think that some people simply don't smell the light, sweet scent that tea roses typically do have. And it is a little like a floral soap. I mean, I use that term, it makes it sound sort of unappealing, but it's actually pleasant. But some people will smell a modern rose and say, I don't smell anything. And I'm smelling it and go, yeah, no, it's got fragrance. It's just not powerfully fragrant. So to that end, I would like to read to you the five categories of fragrance that David Austin describes in his older catalogs. There is fruity. Anybody knows what that is. There are roses that actually have a lemony scent. Sunspray is a good example.
Citrus, rich berry, exotic fruits.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. They smell sort of like a fruit compote but mostly berry or citrus smelling. And that's recognizable. Most people know what that is. Old rose. That's
traditional, warm, heady, slightly sweet.
Yeah, but strong, typically, rather pungent. And that's what people are saying. Well, modern roses don't smell like that. Well, that's true. They have a different profile. Myrrh. Okay.
This is described as distinctive, spicy, sweet anise, medicinal.
Yeah, myrrh is like frankincense, one of the gifts that the three magi took to Jesus, and it's a resin, and it's got a resinous scent, and it would not necessarily be considered pleasant all in and of itself, but mixed with the other sweeter compounds, it's just a distinctive, spicy scent. And then tea is the one that we're describing here, which he describes as being...
fresh tea, slightly spicy, fruity, sweet.
But very light. Typically, it's not a strong scent. Rose fragrance comes from volatile organic compounds, and some have a lot more than others. And then the last one is musk. And the musk roses are a particular category of roses and one of my favorite groups, but their scent is distinctive.
Warm, rich, spicy, clove, sweet.
Musk roses have been the true musk rose, Rosa muscata, was long ago bred in with some other roses, and there's a whole category that are called hybrid musk roses. What's unique about them is they release their fragrance only in the evening, predominantly. So you're walking by just at dusk, and all of a sudden you're this very heady aroma from a plant several feet away. So their volatile organic compounds are quite volatile. And to me, they smell like honeysuckle. So that's a fragrance many people can relate to. Sweet, but spicy. And again, certain time of day. So the reason some roses are a lot more fragrant than others has to do with where they produce those volatile organic compounds. There's known to be several dozen individual chemicals involved in different mixes in different roses. And they are in the petals, in some cases, only down at the base of the anthers, in other cases, all throughout the petals and even the sepals, in the case of some very fragrant roses. Some of them you walk up and you get the fragrance right away. Others, it's only at certain times of day. Those are typically ones where the flower is more or less closed. And then as it opens out, especially that evening when it has opened out, it releases its maximum amount of volatile organic compounds, presumably to attract pollinators of various types. And so you'll get some of them more fragrant in the early evening. An example is iceberg, which has become incredibly popular, propagates easily, incredibly easy to grow. Most people walking up and smelling an iceberg rose flower midday will barely get any scent out of it at all. But if they're walking by it at dusk, it'll be surprisingly fragrant. So catalog descriptions are all over the place on that one. Some of them say not fragrant, others say very sweet fragrance, presumably depending on the time of day that the author went up to the plant. So fragrance varies. It is true that some roses were selected for long stems and vase life, as they call it, that opens slowly in a vase. And I did read a detailed scientific analysis several years ago of how that inadvertently did select for low scent in some roses, because it happens that the genes that control the opening of the flower interact with the genes that control the release or the presence of volatile organic compounds. So they were inadvertently selecting for low fragrance when they were selecting for long vase life. So it is true to some degree that florist roses, roses you buy in a bouquet at the florist or the grocery store, are typically going to be very lightly scented. Part of that is preferred. The florist industry doesn't want to hand you a Chrysler Imperial bouquet and have you pass out while you're standing there holding it. You want to have something with a light, pleasant scent, if any, at all. It's not really a desirable characteristic in the florist industry, and it turns out they were inadvertently selecting for lower scent when they were selecting for longer vase life. But that's not always true. And I will say this, the general comment, modern roses aren't as fragrant as older roses. There are exceptions. So many, I could make a whole list of modern roses that are extremely fragrant. Many of them have names that say things like fragrant cloud, you know, so you know that one's fragrant. So there are very, very heavily scented modern roses. Usually that fragrance comes from the hybrid perpetual parentage, not the tea rose parentage.
So a couple of thoughts on this. One is, with the five descriptions of the rose fragrance, is there any rose that has all five shoved together in it? It's like a composite.
The first four, fruity, old rose, myrrh, and tea, could all be present. Musk would be a little unusual. That just seems to be characteristic of a particular species and its progeny. So I would say that all these different volatile organic compounds exist to varying degrees in a rose. Whether they are expressed by the rose, whether they actually develop as much of the volatile organic compounds that make the fragrance, does vary, and that, you know, is genetically controlled, obviously. So they will differ, and they also differ at different times of day. You know, this is the thing about roses. One of the cool things about roses, if you ever grow a lot of them, the color changes with temperature. The fragrance changes with temperature. They release more volatile organic compounds under certain atmospheric conditions, or at least you experience more of them. Like fairly still early evening with more humidity, you're going to get more volatile organic compound in your vicinity than on a drier or, of course, a windier day. So be aware that some roses that aren't fragrant the first time you walk up to them will be under different atmospheric conditions or different times of day. And you may be one of those people who just doesn't really smell tea roses, in which case some of the hybrid teas will not seem fragrant and others will. But fragrance is one of those things that garden rose breeders have selected for fragrance. Cut rose breeders have inadvertently selected away from fragrance.
So if I wanted to have, as I do, a rose that I can pluck and take the petals off and use those petals in a little jar for potpourri. Now, some, as far as I understand you, some petals are going to be fragrant and other petals aren't. Do you know if there's any way to tell? Are red roses more fragrant? Does color make a difference?
No, it doesn't correlate with color specifically at all. I can say that.
Do you have a favorite for potpourri?
Any of the hybrid perpetual roses are going to be outstanding for that. Hybrid perpetuals were the most popular 19th century roses, and the ones that have survived in the trade, we're talking about rose growers who are specialists at this point. are going to be the super fragrant ones. And so that whole group will be particularly fragrant. I'll tell you one, if you want to search for it, good luck. I have one. I can take a cutting if anyone's interested. Paul Neyron, N-E-Y-R-O-N, Hybrid Perpetual, strong pink. In fact, it is Neyron pink. That is where the name came from. It was from this particular rose. And it is, when my daughter got married in April a few years ago, happens to be, and it's one glorious full bloom, and it only blooms in the spring, right in time for her wedding. So we just picked buds of this one, several hundred of them, because that's what it produces every year, and filled bowls with them at the wedding. And every table had a bowl filled with the Paul Neyron rose. And even sitting a couple feet away, you could smell the fragrance off of that one. But any 19th century hybrid perpetual rose that is still in the trade is likely to have the fragrance that you're after. You could look for the Gallicas and the Damask roses that are the basis of the perfume industry and all that kind of thing. But they're harder to find. They're not nearly as abundant bloomers. And they're only spring bloomers. And like the Paul Neyron, they only bloom in the spring, whereas many hybrid perpetuals, such as Baron Prevost, continue to bloom through the summer and again in the fall. So I'd look for a repeat blooming hybrid perpetual rose if you're looking for a super fragrant rose. If you don't mind it only blooming in the spring, hit me up and I'll take a cutting of Paul Neyron for you.
And since I just want the potpourri, I mean, I just petals. Why don't I hit you up for a few flowers?
A few bowls of roses. There you go.
And then yeah. I'll have the potpourri, and I won't actually have to grow a bush in my garden for roses anyway.
Yeah, we've been propagating roses ourselves. We have more than half the roses we sell are ones we grow ourselves now at our nursery. And I was selecting for fragrance as well as garden performance. And I considered bringing that particular one into our system, our program. I thought it only blooms in the spring. That's not going to have a market. I'm not going to spend a lot of effort propagating it. But most of them are quite easy. If you happen to encounter a very fragrant rose and it's got some semi-hardwood on it and you want to go ahead and propagate it, it's not that difficult to grow most roses from cuttings. And if they're on their own roots, you never have to worry about rootstock. So we could talk about that another time. But I want to discuss the fragrance because a lot of nurseries right now are bringing in roses in bloom. Our big goal at most garden centers is to have a really good selection of roses for Mother's Day. And they'll bring them in from, you know, wholesalers, and then they'll grow them on. They'll buy them from wholesalers already potted up. And a lot of them are very fragrant. A lot of them will be blooming. And be aware that there's quite a variation in rose fragrance and also in how you perceive rose fragrance. If I say tea rose, you're going to smell it and go, oh, yes, it smells like tea. If I'd said chocolate rose, you might say it smells like chocolate. People are very suggestible when it comes to fragrance.
I'm not sure what China smells like, but...
Yeah, China roses refers to Rosa chinensis, which is extremely important. And California, and especially Northern California growers, have become very familiar with one Rosa chinensis that has become very popular because it's an Arboretum All-Star. Its old name was Rosa chinensis mutabilis. And that refers to mutabilis means changing. It changes.
Beautiful.
Sometimes called the butterfly rose. It opens, see if I've got this right, opens pink and ages to yellow. Maybe I got that backwards. Whatever the case, you have pink and yellow single petaled roses all on this plant all at the same time. And it looks like a host of butterflies have landed on it. It's an Arboretum All-Star, almost always for sale at the Arboretum sales. And it's a big plant, 8x8 if you do nothing, easily pruned, prune it any way you want, never stops blooming, blooms right on into the winter. One of the first to bloom in the spring, very disease resistant. That's a Rosa chinensis. That's one of the China roses. So in mild winter climates, if you're listening in USDA zones 9 or 10, these are the roses that are still blooming in December, still blooming in January, when you go out there to prune them. Old Blush is another popular one that's been around for a long time. And you just prune them anyway, but they don't defoliate. They don't go fully deciduous, and they really don't stop blooming in milder climates, such as most of California.
Well, this is the second week of April, and I wanted to just quickly sprint through the names of the flowers that you have on the April calendar.
Okay.
And I know that these are only a few of the dozens, if not hundreds of pictures you could have put on
your
calendar.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed.
It's April. There's so much blooming out there. I have Strelitzia blooming And that's a bird of paradise. Yeah. That's one of my favorite new favorites for my flowers. Is that Strelitzia.
Interestingly, bird of paradise is becoming very popular and as a garden plant. And a lot of people didn't think it was hardy here in the valley. It's perfectly hardy. They may get damaged by a very, very cold winter, but they do come back from it. Now, it's not an April bloom, it's an anytime bloom. So I don't have a picture of it on the calendar.
January.
Yeah, can be. Yes. In San Diego, they bloomed right through the winter. So.
Okay, so we have peony, ranunculus, tulip, clivia, rosa, that's rose,
yep.
Carpentaria, clematis, cereus hybrid?
Those are cactus. Hmm? That's a cactus.
Oh, cactus. Yeah, okay, sweet blossom, yep. Iris, bluebells, pelargonium, that's a geranium type thing,
yep.
And berberis, viola, and aquilegia. And what you do not have in there is bilbergia,
There's lots of things I don't have in there. There's so many things blooming in the month of April. Irises, they're about to hit their big, big, big bloom. So this is a great time to look at irises, take pictures of them. If if you go out to one of those iris gardens and jot down varieties that you like, it is only a 3 to 4 week bloom, but it's spectacular. And there are varieties that do repeat bloom. So it's their big season.
There are repeat bloom iris?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there have been repeat blooming irises forever. I have a variety that my grandfather gave me. So he gave it to me in the 1970s. And he got it in the 1940s. So I have now had, this is a plant, these are divisions of plants that have been in our family for 80 years, I guess, if I do my math correctly. Eleanor Roosevelt. So that tells you roughly when it was introduced. And it's a lot of iris people know this one. It's very, very common. Short plant, blooms about 2 feet high, standard purple bloom. And I have pictures of it blooming with frost on it midwinter, pictures of it blooming in the fall. There have always been repeat blooming or ever blooming. Repeat blooming is really a better term for it. So if you go to the Iris Society show and sale, which is later in the season, they will have some indicated as repeat blooming. And that's a big advantage for irises, because otherwise the bloom season is pretty narrow. If you're a photographer, irises are really fun to photograph. I mean, the flower is so convoluted and fascinating in its structure, and the colors are so intense that it's worth growing a few of them, even if you're not super into irises. If you happen to be into photography, it's a great plant for that.
So before we get into the questions that have been sent in to us, I want to talk about spacing. Now, this is kind of an off the wall kind of a thing, but think about this. So you're going to plant a plant, and it's going to be next to your house, your garage, your fence, whatever. And you look it up. This is a smart thing to do, is to look it up and see how big it's going to get. And it says 6 by 6 by 6. So that's 6 feet wide, 6 feet deep, 6 feet tall. Okay, great. Wonderful. Where are you going to plant it? You better be planting that thing 4 feet away from your house. Or when it's full grown, the wind blows, it'll be scraping the paint off your house.
Depends on what it is, but yeah. Yes.
Yeah. But I mean, it's like, so think about the size of the plant when it's full grown. Now, not that saying that you can't control it, you can certainly prune things, but in general, give it enough room.
Yes, one of the most common complaints I have about landscape designs that we are asked to evaluate when people want us, for example, to make a price list and see if we can order the materials for them, is that a lot of designers do plant way closer together, higher density planting than is necessary. Part of that is so it looks good right away. I've gotten in the middle of this myself. I mean, when I'm choosing plants for an area where I'm choosing shrubs that are going to get a few feet across, and I plant those and we plant some of the lower growing things, it looks sparse at first. There's a facility where I've been advising on a lot of the plants, and I've just taken to adding on at the end of the list one flat 4-inch color, because I know that once we get done planting the things that I have left room for, the ladies who run the landscape committee there are going to come in by a flat of geraniums and plant them in the spaces. That's fine. I just don't design them in. And actually, that's a great approach. Plant the woody plants with enough space. Let's say you plant a Spirea vanhootii, bridal wreath. That's going to be 6 feet across. But it doesn't look like that when you plant it. When you plant it, it looks like it's going to be 3 by 3. So give it plenty of room. Okay, it looks too bare at first. You know what? Stick in a geranium. You'll be happy. and do something like one of these relatively short-lived perennials. Geraniums in our area can go many years, but after a while they get woody or they sort of fall apart and people want to cut them back or take them out. Well, by then, Spirea should be filling that spot. So there are soft perennials that fit very nicely and fill the gaps. I don't like to see woody plants, shrubs, crowded, because then no one individual in that group is going to develop to its maximum potential. This brings us to one of the questions we got in the mailbag, actually. Give them enough room to develop. Plan for pruning if that's appropriate. But, you know, putting a photinia under a window, which is one of the most common mistakes I see, which is a 12 to 15 foot shrub under a window, it's going to be pruned all the time. And that's just pointless. I mean, seriously, there are, let's talk really generic shrubs. If you're going to put a shrub under a window, use a Raphiolepis. I mean, there's other choices, but if you're choosing something like that, choose a shrub that will stay, let's say, roughly the height of the window and wouldn't require constant pruning. I don't fault the gardening services that go through commercial landscapes or multifamily residential compounds and shear everything, because that's what they have to do. It's a problem of plant selection, not maintenance, typically. And so let's choose our plants carefully. Long, long, long ago, I did a consultation on a large multifamily complex in Davis, and all of the windows had junipers planted underneath them, which wouldn't be my first, second, or even third choice.
And but you can't top a juniper per and have it live?
Had they chosen one of the shorter growing types, that would have been fine, but they didn't. They chose a bigger one, so the poor maintenance company had to come in every couple months and shear them. And, you know, there's almost nothing that looks as bad as a geometrically shaped juniper. It just doesn't work with them. And so I'm walking through going, let's just rip all of these out and put in shrubs or perennials that are appropriate to that spot. It was a plant selection problem. The landscape committee wanted to dump on the maintenance crew and say, we need a new maintenance gardener. I said, well, what are you going to tell the new maintenance gardener? What are you going to direct them to do with these junipers? Allow them to block the windows? No. So rant over. Yeah. Just choose the appropriate plant for the situation so you won't have to be pruning it all the time. I know someone who I sometimes co-host shows with who was commenting on gardening less around her place, you know, backing off from active gardening. Well, you know what really can fill in? The shrubs, appropriately chosen, allowed to grow to their natural size, therefore chosen for that, that give a season of bloom or some nice colorful foliage that maybe once a year someone goes out and clips them a little bit, if that. There's a lot of them that you don't even have to do that to. So if you're backing off from beds of annuals or big areas full of vegetables, there are great woody plants that will fill them, but let's give them enough room to develop. I mean, this is a really important point. And if there's gaps between them, stick in some geraniums.
Or in my case, wood chips.
Wood chips work fine. Yes, it depends on what you're after. So, okay, good. All good right. Topic.
Let's go to messages we've gotten in the email. And if someone wants to send us a message, where do they send it, Don?
DavisGardenShow@gmail.com.
So Tanya had written to us earlier about the fence between her yard and the neighbor's yard, and they had lost the screening. And so we talked about this on the show. In fact, we talked a couple of shows about this. Mm-hmm. So here is her message now. And this was just 3 days ago. Hi, Don and Lois. I might need some help. Our neighbors are fine with me purchasing the plants for their yard. They just wanted plants that attract hummingbirds. And I went to the UC Davis Arboretum plant sale today to buy them. I picked up four Callistemon, quote, McCarthy, unquote, because the UCD tag said that they get up to 7 feet tall. But when I went online, it looked like they only get 4 to 5 feet tall, which wouldn't be tall enough for our needs. Can these get 7 feet tall? If not, I'll give them a friend with a farm and get another variety at the next sale. The two other varieties they have available are, quote, Red Alert, unquote, and, quote, Slim, unquote. Please let me know your thoughts. Thank you.
So there are a bunch of new, relatively new bottle brush. That's the group we're talking about here. These are shrubs that are from Australia that do very, very well in California, which strongly attract hummingbirds. Again, interesting since there are no hummingbirds in Australia, but like grevilleas, which are also Australian shrubs, Callistemon, the bottle brush, very much attract hummingbirds, and certain types of bees, the Xylocopa or carpenter bees, are very attracted to them as well. Your regular old-fashioned bottle brush would certainly do the job. I mean, that's Callistemon, usually sold as Callistemon citrinus or Callistemon viminalis. That's a big plant. I have some on my property here, my farm, where I've planted them, irrigated till established, and then stopped watering. Okay, which I like to do with very low water shrubs, maybe once a month watering in a dry summer, in a dry winter year, like a drought. Other than that, they're pretty much on their own. Regular bottle brush, Callistemon viminalis, is about 10 by 10. So that would do the job.
Mine is 14 tall.
This, yeah, and I'm referring to something I planted 15 years ago. And over time, I'm sure they will get bigger. Also, I've done no pruning on it. I've done no pruning on mine. I could prune it up and make it more tree-like. I have growers who train them as trees. So giving you an exact height for a bottle brush is a little challenging, actually.
Well, I would say that if the UCD tag says they get up to 7 feet tall, mm-hmm. and then you go online and you find some random website that says they're only 4 to 5 feet tall. Maybe that's in their area. I would trust the UCD tag. Well, but not, didn't you go and look at the grower in Australia?
Yeah, and they say 7 feet. So I would trust 7 feet tall. Okay, so that it will do that. Now, you also can affect it. I mean, I have growers that take some of the varieties, like Slim is an interesting one, very columnar upright growth habit. I had some come in from a grower in 5 gallon cans that were already 7 feet tall. Okay, because obviously they'd grown them can to can in the wholesale yard, they'd staked them. And I'm looking at these going, these would make a great tree. I don't think my customers are really prepared for that. So I'm pondering what to do with them. But they're already over your fence, planted from a 5 gallon container. That's a variety called Slim. Slim is a very narrow, upright grower. Every now and then you'll
get need a lot more plants.
You need them closer together. It kind of dovetails with that conversation we're having about spacing. If you did Slim, you'd probably need them 4 to 5 feet apart to give the density or the screen that you're after. Or they could be part of, always my preference, a mixed edge of varying heights and varying textures and bloom seasons of different flowers. But Slim would be a very good one. I can tell you for sure, Slim will easily get 7 feet plus. And
so will the one that she has.
Probably, yes. Although it sounds like she's given that one away and is going
to
go.
All right, let's go on to the next message from her.
Yep.
So 2 days later, yeah. Which is 2 days ago, she wrote to us, "Hello, I found a home for the MacArthur bottle brush plants mm-hmm. that I bought." Oh, she gave them away.
That's cool. That's wonderful. Someone else gets something
good. I'm not sure if the Slim or Red Alert is the best bottle brush to plant with the pineapple guava and the Grevillea Canberra gem. Maybe I'm overthinking it. Maybe Don carries some bottle brush plants at the Redwood Barn. I kept the toy on because it looked terrible at the plant sale. It had brown and black spots all over the leaves. So, Don.
Well, that was a couple topics right there. Yes, Toyon, it can be a chronic problem for retailers because they come in, they do get leaf spot diseases. They do plant out fine. Generally, they outgrow that, so I wouldn't be too concerned about that. If I were choosing from all the ones you've mentioned, you already have Feijoa, the pineapple guava, and you already have the Canberra gem Grevillea, I would use the Slim bottle brush. I think that will do what you're after. You might want to stake it up, because you can affect the height by how you train it or prune it. And I think you could get that up to 8 to 10 feet with no problem as long as you stake it correctly or are just patient enough to let it grow that big. And that would be an amazing mix of flowers. You would have Feijoa blooming in the spring, attracting mockingbirds and jays, which love the flowers. I remember my mother swearing at the, in our case, scrub jays in San Diego, and also mockingbirds that would come in and strip the flowers off of the Feijoa. They're edible. They're sweet, by the way. If you've ever seen a pineapple guava in bloom, try a petal. They're very sweet. They're very tasty. Apparently, the birds like them as well. She was afraid she wouldn't get any fruit, and that was true to a degree. They really took off a lot of the flowers. But generally speaking, most people that have a Feijoa that fruits find that any amount is plenty. They tend to be very heavy producers, and it's not the fruit that you use a whole lot of. But that would be blooming really pretty, drawing birds. And you'd have the Grevillea, which blooms heavily in the winter. My biggest bloom on my different Grevilleas is November through February, and then they scattered bloom. Well, my one of mine is in full bloom right now, and the hummingbirds are just going nuts on it. But it's a cool season bloom predominantly going into the spring. And then you'd have the bottle brush, which interestingly bloom in cycles, about every 2 to 3 months, any time of year. My regular bottle brush can be in bloom in January, can be in bloom in April to May. The bloom structure is fascinating. You look at the inflorescence and it's like it blooms, then it puts on another foot of growth and it blooms again. So you'd have a lot of flowers there. And if you wanted to mix in a couple California natives that would go with that, the Toyon would give you the berries in the wintertime and the flowers that would attract beneficials in the spring, and be patient with them. But once they get going, they're surprisingly fast growing. And then you could even do something like a ceanothus if you have room for it and don't mind the fact that here in the valley they tend to have a 3 to 7 year lifespan, but during that time they're spectacular. So give them enough room, give the plants nearby enough room that they'll fill in once the ceanothus finally goes, and you'd have an amazing hedge there. You'd be very active with birds and beneficial insects, and you have berries in the winter time, and you might even have some edible fruit.
So you mentioned like six different species.
Yeah. And usually pretty fast too.
one would plant more than one bush of the same species so that you repeat a little bit.
From a design standpoint, it's good to repeat. Yeah.
Yeah. And some of these things are going to get 6 to 8 feet wide.
Correct.
That's an awful long bit of fence.
Yeah, 6 to 8 foot spacing would be reasonable for these. And you should be prepared as they're growing to not let any one crowd any other one. And so look in particular at the ones with the more outward growth habit. The grevillea, for example, tends to be out and up. And so you'd have to clip them in a little bit to make space for the nearby plant. But I think you could do it. I think that would all work very nicely, as long as you start with enough space so you're not having to constantly prune them. Also, one thing to note, grevilleas are a little prickly. Put them where you won't have to prune them all the time. But they're a great plant. And everything you've described there in here in the Sacramento Valley, USDA zone 9, sunset zone 14 or 8 or 9, you wouldn't have to irrigate any of those plants once established. Those could all be unirrigated. Now, they would grow faster and probably look a little better with a deep soaking, let's say once a month. But I have grevilleas and bottle brush that, and actually a feijoa, that if they get 3 soakings during the course of a typical summer, they're thrilled. oftentimes I let them go all summer. The grevillea pink pearl that's on my property is where the foxes nest. And so I just, you know, that's been their primary prickly den that they like to hide in. So I tend not to disturb that area very much. It means I also tend not to irrigate it. And they're just fine with that. Grevilleas can be as low irrigation as California native plants. So can bottle brush. The biggest problem I see with bottle brush, and there's probably some people out there going, really, bottle brush? What an ugly looking plant. Yeah, if you irrigate it a lot, it can be really ugly looking. It actually can get quite anemic and can get kind of yellowish. It is actually a plant that doesn't go well in a frequently irrigated landscape. It will show chronic micronutrient deficiencies in that situation. And so there's a lot of very scruffy looking bottle brush out there. Whereas when they're deep watered infrequently and then allowed to go essentially into almost unirrigated settings, they tend to look very good. So it's a great choice for a low water landscape and lots of bloom on all the things you just described.
So the three that she was talking about from the Arboretum, the MacArthur, the Slim, and the Red Alert, are those common in the trade, or do you get different ones than those, and those are special?
Those have become more common in the trade, especially that narrow upright growth habit on the Slim has made it rather popular. The one that's really common in the trade, if you just want a bottle brush because you like them, is the Little John, the little miniature one that only gets like 3 to 4 feet. Won't do what she's after, but if you happen to want a bottle brush in your garden because of the long bloom season and the fact they're attractive to hummingbirds and carpenter bees, that's a great choice. Little John has become very popular. Easy to kill by overwatering, so put it in a low water landscape and it'll be very successful.
All right, so we talked about the rose, we talked about that. Okay, so I'm going to go to this next thing, which is, wait a minute. Oh, this is a question that Don says he gets a lot. Why isn't the city planting the native redbud tree? Now, they are planting redbud trees, right?
Right. We at Tree Davis were planting redbuds as trees here and there, and the city of Davis has done so as well. And the one that we're predominantly recommending and planting as a tree, important distinction, is the Oklahoma variety of redbud, which is a...
Our native redbud isn't a tree. It's a multi-stem...
Well,
bush,
that's
it?
The crux of the issue right there. Actually, that's the first part of it. Yes, Oklahoma redbud is a variant of the eastern redbud that's from... Well, the full official name I love is Circis, or Circus, C-E-R-C-I-S, Canadensis, Texensis, variety Oklahoma. What does that tell you?
Wait a minute.
Okay. Should I go through that again? Circis, Canadensis, subspecies Texensis, cultivar, Oklahoma. So that is a drier adapted eastern redbud, I guess is the way I would describe it. It is a variant of the eastern redbud. Circis occidentalis is our western redbud. Occidental means western. Circis canadensis just tells you that it's from the east coast. And in general, eastern redbuds are not really great choices here in California, in the drier parts of California, because most of the eastern redbuds have thin leaves that don't have a nice, thick, waxy coating on them. And so every summer... Right after a heat wave, people will walk in and say, what are all the spots on these leaves? What's wrong with my redbud? And I say, that looks like the variety Forest Pansy or one of the other eastern redbuds. They really are only suitable here as an understory tree where you would grow Japanese maples. If you live in Land Park, Sacramento, if you live in an older neighborhood with a great high canopy of elms or something, then those eastern redbuds might be suitable. They're also not drought tolerant at all. But Oklahoma variant of the Texensis subspecies of eastern redbud is drought tolerant, and if you look at the leaf, you can see why. It's thicker and it's got a waxy coating on it. So it can take the heat better and it can take drought better. It's best if you deep water it, but it can tolerate drought. So it's one of those plants that can go in an irrigated landscape or a less irrigated landscape. I don't think I would put it in a completely xeric unirrigated landscape, but it probably could survive that. It would just look better with a little, maybe once a month watering during the summer. So it's proving to be very, very adaptable. Our western redbud has a problem here. One, it's easy to overwater. It's easy to kill it. It needs to be in a low water landscape. I have them on my farm, and the other thing they do is a branchial die. Just abruptly. It doesn't appear to be Phytophthora. It's not a crown rot thing because the rest of the plant will remain perfectly healthy. So it's probably a fungus like Cercospora or Botrytis furia or one of these infecting diseases that gets in on the stem or at the crown and just kills everything beyond that point, that whole side of the plant. I have a beautiful western redbud along my driveway, 6-7 years old, just finished blooming. Last summer, about June, 1/3 of it just died. One whole branch simply died. Well, if you've trained it up as a tree with a single trunk, that could be a problem.
Dead in the water.
And the whole thing.
Because of the water.
Right. Or just because it does that. Because this is where mine is, I basically don't even irrigate it. So this happened after a wet year. Yes, after a wet winter. But I wasn't irrigating it. And all of a sudden, one part of the plant died. So the comment is basically just as your little western redbud tree is getting established as a tree, you could lose the whole top. And then, of course, it will re-sprout, so that's okay, but then you have a bush. So the reason we're not recommending or planting it as a tree is that it really isn't a tree. If you want to see some great examples of how western redbud grows, go to the Warren G. Roberts Redbud Collection, the UC Davis Arboretum. There's still some bloom on them. You can see what the new leaves look like. It's a wonderful plant. It's got beautiful sort of bluish green foliage, really interesting color. The round leaves are very attractive. All kinds of beneficial insects come to the western redbud. I like to sell them to people as part of a mix of low water landscape shrubs. And it really isn't suitable as a tree because it simply doesn't make a single trunk tree. We had a long debate about this in this larger committee that I'm on, where we're going through almost 400 species and cultivars of different things. What do we do with the ones that are actually shrubs, but that sometimes are grown as trees? And they get their own categories. Xylosoma is a really good example, very drought tolerant, can get as big as a tree, but rarely grown that way. Pineapple guava, the feijoa or acca siloiana, can get as big as a tree, 15 feet, but rarely grown with a single trunk. So our consensus was, go ahead and list these on a list of trees, but in a kind of a different category. They're almost sure to be multi-trunk. That goes for elderberries. That goes for box elder, the Acer negunda, which is native here. They're never with a single trunk. And so if you're going to plant these in a landscape, it wouldn't be used as a street tree, because street trees, you need to be able to get under them. You need to be able to pass under them on the sidewalk or park under them. So they're not going to be appropriate for that kind of setting. But people do want to use these in landscapes in some situations. As a large shrub or multi-trunk tree is the best way we could probably put it. So they really aren't suitable as a street tree, and they aren't also not suitable where they're going to get summer irrigation, whereas the Oklahoma redbud can tolerate that. Rains in Oklahoma in the summer, doesn't usually rain here in the summer.
So Don sent me a little thing that says, current questions. These are questions that have been presented to him at his nursery. And so, can I grow Alstroemeria from seed?
Yes, you can, but not the one you're thinking of. So this is interesting. Alstroemeria, quick. The common name of Alstroemeria is?
Peruvian lily.
And it's not a true lily, so it's important to know, because there's a lot of information out there about lilies and their toxicity to cats and all that kind of thing. But Peruvian lily.
And it's the plant that you see in the florist trade. This is the one that you get in bouquets.
Oh, yeah. It's very common in bouquets. A blossom will last for 7 to 10 days in an arrangement. They're not a lily, but they look kind of like a lily. So like so many things, it's called something lily, Peruvian lily. Alstroemerias that you see in those arrangements are not grown from seed. They're propagated vegetatively from rhizomes. An Alstroemeria plant is a rhizome like an iris, but really thin and really fragile. So they're never sold as rhizomes. If you want a particular color, it's just a division that's been potted up and sold to you. Yes, however, there is a strain of Alstroemeria that you can grow from seed, and it's really easy. In fact, the very first Alstroemerias I ever grew, when I was 16 years old, were from seed. The Ligtu hybrids, L-I-G-T-U hybrids. You can still find the seed quite readily. Park Seed Company still sells it. And read the instructions, and they're really quite easy from seed, and it's an old-fashioned Alstroemeria. So their bloom spikes, the ones I grew anyway in San Diego, 4 to 5 feet tall. So it's one of that kind. And they do spread by rhizomes. They do form rhizomes once the seedling grows up and makes a plant. You do need to be patient. They won't bloom probably till the second or maybe even the third year, but they're easy. They're not difficult to grow from seed. Alstroemerias are indestructible garden plants. I mean, I have some that I planted in full sun, which are now in full shade 20 plus years later, doing just fine. They grow a little differently.
And those are 4 feet tall?
Well, the Ligtu hybrids get 4 feet tall, and some of the old fashioned ones like Dusky Maiden and Regina and some of the others get 3 feet plus. They're definitely big sprawling plants. The one, if you go by Redwood Barn Nursery, you'll see some Alstroemerias in the front garden bed that we've been gradually trying to pull out for about 25 years. We planted those in the 1980s from 4-inch pots. It's the old fashioned sort of dusky pink one. It's migrated down to where it's infiltrated a big clump of Nandina. Great use for Nandina, holding up Alstroemeria flowers. Makes it look like the Nandina is blooming. So it's a plant that will spread, and the old fashioned ones would spread more. I mean, they will go several feet across over time, and their blooms are big and tall and floppy. So they weren't as popular as garden plants. What's really become popular for home gardeners are these much tighter growing ones. And also the range of colors has vastly expanded. There's red, there's purple, colors that never existed in Alstroemerias 25, 30 years ago. But there are also a whole series of them now, the Inca series and some of the others that only grow a foot tall. They look like little azalea when they're in bloom. They aren't long enough for cutting, so that's important to know. These aren't going to be cut flowers, but they're great garden flowers. And the amazing thing about Alstroemerias is that, as I said, 7 to 10 days in a vase, 2 to 3 weeks on a plant, from the time the flower bud opens until it's finally done and you decide to deadhead it or just not worry about it. And the plant continues to look good right on into midsummer. Some of these new hybrids continue right on through the summer. The newer Alstroemerias have gotten more and more dwarf, more compact, less spready. The old-fashioned ones, which I do like to sell when I can get them, more spreading, great for the back of the border, will migrate, be aware of where they're going to go, plan for that, and they're great garden plants. But yes, to answer the basic question, there is a strain out there that's been around for a long time, pastel shades, pink, pale orange, white, really easy to grow, 4 foot long bloom spikes, so plan for that. The Ligtu, L-I-G-T-U, Ligtu hybrids can be grown from seed. Other than that, you're buying vegetatively propagated rhizomes. 1 year, I found a source of the rhizomes, and I thought, great, we'll bring these in and sell them. In came this jumble of what looked like little tiny iris rhizomes. As soon as you picked them up, they started breaking apart. We quickly realized this is not a plant you put out for, a rhizome that you put out for the consumer to rummage through and buy by the each. We potted them immediately. And from that point on, I thought, no, we're just going to let the growers grow Alstroemerias and we will sell them when they got them ready and coming into bloom, because it's not something that lends itself to you purchasing in the rhizome form. But they're very, very easy plants to grow. Important, if you're buying them, to read the label and check the height of the plant, because some of them are so short, you might even want to do them in a container. Others are big, sprawling, or indeed spreading plants that you might want to plan for when you put them in your border. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.